Listen, everybody, we all know that real estate is the most proven way to build wealth. But why isn't everyone wealthy from real estate then? It's hard to know where to start, and most of the education out there is just complete trash, and you end up investing your money on a series of courses instead of in real estate. That's not how this podcast works. We give you the blueprint to successful real estate investing and bring on guests actually willing to share their secrets. I started my real estate investing journey as a freshman in college when I bought my first duplex and have been in the trenches doing deals ever since. And today, I now own hundreds of millions of dollars of investment property. On this podcast, you will learn what you actually need to know to be a successful active or passive real estate investor. And we'll offer our takes on what's happening today so you can navigate this market and build wealth. I'm Drew Brenneman, and this is the Brenneman Blueprint. Tyler Lyons, Chief Investment Officer at ASIM Capital, is on the show today. Welcome, Tyler.
Thanks, Drew. Really excited to be here today.
Yeah, glad to have you. And I know you just spoke in front of 1,000+ people last month. How was that?
It was amazing, man. It was amazing. And before we get into that, too, I just want to say, we've gotten to know each other a lot better the last year or so. And it's been great to get to know you. The more I get to know you, the more impressed I am in terms of just your knowledge in the industry. And I've been really, I'm a big fan of yours and really impressed with you. So I'm excited to be on the show here today. It's a huge privilege. And it was really interesting. So for those of the listeners who maybe didn't hear about Raise Fest, it was a huge festival that was here in Phoenix, where I'm located. And it was focused really on raising capital. So commercial real estate conference focused on raising capital. And I had the pleasure of speaking in front of about 1,000 people at that conference, which is a big number. And just to give the listeners a better flavor for it as well, RaiseFest isn't your typical real estate conference because, when you're coming out on stage to speak, you've got loud techno music, you've got lights, you've got massive LED screens with your name and your picture on it and stuff. You've got smoke machines. Like, it really is it's quite a sight to behold. And, as you're kind of backstage getting ready to come out, it almost has the feel of like coming out for like, you're doing the walk for like a UFC event or a WWE event or something like that, So it was pretty nerve-wracking, but very exciting and exhilarating all at the same time. But, I'm not a professional speaker either. And in fact, not that long ago, I was actually deathly afraid of public speaking too. So maybe we can start this off with just a really quick story here. About 8 years or so ago, I got asked by one of my best friends to be his best man. And as we all know, that means you're gonna get up there and do the speech, right? And when you're from the middle of nowhere, Podunk, Michigan, like I am, when somebody from the community gets married, everybody in the whole city comes, right? So I knew it was going to be a huge crowd. So I was deathly afraid of public speaking. I knew I had this thing coming up. So I had a few months to prepare. So I started going to Toastmasters, and I was so scared of public speaking at that point in time that I went to do my first speech at Toastmasters. Again, this is about 8 years or so ago. And that first speech is literally the easiest public speaking engagement in the entire world. You've got like 8 to 10 people. And you talk for like 5 minutes about who you are and your life and what you like. And I was so nervous going to that first meeting that I drove back and forth in front of the building for like 45 minutes before I finally went in there. And then when I finally went in there, the session was over and I missed my opportunity. So I say all that to say, after getting on stage at RaiseFest and speaking in front of 1,000 people only 8 years later, It feels pretty good. Personally, from that perspective, it's a big feather in my cap. So I'm really grateful that I had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's a great story. And then when have you got comfortable with the speaking yet, or now you just know you're going to be nervous and get out there?
Yeah, it's a really good question, man. And I've definitely gotten more of a comfort level with it now compared to what it used to be back then. It's one of those things where there's probably always going to be some level of nervousness before I go out there and do it, but it's not the anxiety that it used to be. It's almost more of just like that nervous excitement. So it's definitely changed a lot. But I think that I'll recommend for people out there who are trying to do things that they're scared of these days, like I'll recommend a book that I think is really good. It's called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Dr. Susan Jeffers. Great book. And if you're an entrepreneur out there and there are things that you're scared of that you're not facing down, I mean, it could be the difference between success and not having success. So I would definitely recommend that book. And it really allowed me to just have a healthier relationship with fear. And just knowing as well that like myself, you, Drew, like other people who are out there in the industry, for people who are like really driving hard and trying to do big things, everybody's scared. Like everybody has certain things that you're going to be scared of. And as you break through certain levels and make it to new levels, there's going to be new things that you're scared of. So just kind of knowing that you're never going to completely escape it and just kind of like building a comfort level with that in a weird way, I think it helps me to kind of get over it mentally. And it makes me kind of, it's made me a lot stronger going forward once I've kind of had that realization.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I heard some quote, which I'm not going to get exactly right, but it was, you know, whatever you're sort of most afraid of is what you need to be doing, like for your business, or that's like the thing that you know you need to do, but it's you're holding yourself back not doing it. And yeah, I don't know about you when you started your, doing the Cashflow Connections podcast, where how nervous you were. But for me personally, when I started doing this podcast, we did them all in person. And I had a videographer, and then who's like a really good videographer and does some really high end videos in Chicago. And then he'd have like an assistant with him, and you have your guests. So I'm doing this in front of like, you know, 3 or 4 people now, and I have no idea what I'm doing as the host. So it was really, that was really tough getting those going. Actually doing these remote without people watching you is a bit easier. But yeah, that I was definitely very nervous for those first ones, and you can tell, in the intro, like I sound like I'm trembling, and I definitely was. So
I really appreciate that you brought that up, because that's something as well that doing a podcast, or anybody out there who's aspiring to, if you're a real estate entrepreneur, an aspiring real estate entrepreneur, I encourage pretty much everybody to start a podcast, even if nobody listens to it, even if you're just screaming into the void every single week and you're not building a large listenership or followership, the communication skills that you build after doing a bunch of these, like Drew, I'm sure you've probably experienced the same thing. Like for me, that's another thing that's made me more comfortable speaking in public, is I've done over 100 of these now. And my communication skills when I first started compared to what they are now, it's literally night and day. It's literally night and day. So, there's a lot that goes into it. If you're going to do a podcast, like it's a time commitment, the grind of getting guests on every single week, week in, week out, preparing and doing it. It's a commitment, but I will say, like, it's been one of the best professional development things that I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I don't know how much more it made me comfortable speaking in person. I'll have to do some real public speaking to find out, but definitely. So, you know, I went to Race Fest too, obviously, and, you know, it was a, awesome event. And while I was there, Charles, Zhu, he was, and I always butcher his last name, but he was like, you want to hop on my podcast? And normally I would have been like, you know, sweating bullets, you know, and I'm like, yeah, sure. Let's just do it. When do you want to do it? He's like, how about in like an hour? Like, sounds good. And so, you know, you go in there, it's like a 3-camera setup, and he's, you know, it's interviewing you, and you know you're not nervous at all now, because it's like, well, yeah, I've done enough of these things where I know where how this is going to go. And you know, it's funny, is the only thing I was worried about when I was sitting there, I'm like, oh, on this couch, my stomach's going to look big. That's, I know what it's going to look like. It's like, it's at a funny angle, so I'm like, oh man, this will be would have been better to be 5 pounds lighter for that podcast. That was the only worry I had on that one. Well, nice. Well, yeah, Tyler, let's just start with, I guess, how you got into real estate. I'd like to hear, you know, kind of from the beginning. Some of it I've heard, but, you know, and I haven't heard your whole story even, so.
Yeah, sounds good. So my pathway into real estate is a little bit different than yours, Drew. Like, you started very young, right? You started at like 19 years old. You pretty much, I joke, you rolled out of the womb pretty much doing real estate, which for you, it's amazing. You've got this long period of history to draw on. I didn't start my career in real estate. I actually started my career in the world of accounting and finance. And nobody as a kid grows up and says, hey, I want to be a CPA when I grow up, at least not any kids that I knew. So I kind of just stumbled into the world of accounting and finance. I did have an entrepreneurial just inclination, I would say, when I was 18 and 19 years old. I studied entrepreneurship for a year in college, but realized pretty early on, it's like, well, you know what? I don't really have any good ideas. I don't really have any business skills right now to speak of. So why don't I just get a degree, get out into the corporate world, start building some skills, and then maybe someday in the future, I can circle back and start scratching this entrepreneurial itch. So yeah, I worked for a big four public accounting firm for about 6 years coming out of college, got my CPA, realized that I didn't want to go the partner route at a large public accounting firm. So shortly thereafter, I left. I started working for a pretty large publicly traded manufacturing company back in Michigan where I grew up. And, you know, started there as kind of a finance manager sort of role and started climbing the ranks pretty early. And after a couple of years, I got promoted to a director role. So I was, 30 years old, director of corporate finance for a large publicly traded company. I had a big team, you know, nice six-figure salary, bonus, benefits. Like from the outside, like everything looked like it was hunky-dory, right? Got this nice job and, you know, I'm aiming to be a CFO of a publicly traded company. Like that's kind of where my mindset was. Like after I got that promotion, it's like, all right, like this is what I want to do. But then you get into that role and you start grinding it out for a few years and you start to get a sense for the reality of what it really would mean to be the CFO of a publicly traded company. And the longer that I busted my tail in that role, the more that type of work just really, it just really was a bit soul crushing for me. It was, challenging and difficult. And that wasn't really the reason that I kind of started to fall out of love with it. It's more just the nature of the work. It wasn't really what I wanted to do. It wasn't what got me excited anymore. So I kind of came to this realization of like, okay, I've invested over a decade, 12, 13 years into this career, building myself up to this particular point in time. But what do I do now? So I started searching, Drew. I started listening to podcasts. I started reading books. I started watching YouTube videos. I was just searching. I didn't know what I was searching for. I couldn't decide if I wanted to just change careers. I couldn't decide if I wanted to go out and buy a business. I couldn't decide if I want to start a business. It was very much just exploration sort of mode at that point in time. And eventually, I stumbled across, it would have been BiggerPockets that was my first foray into real estate. Just found real estate on the internet, right? BiggerPockets podcast. Started looking at the blog and started self-educating. And my first property was a crappy little duplex a couple miles down the road from my house at that point in time. $75,000 property. It was a disgusting property. Like drug activity in there, cockroaches everywhere. It was a doozy. Like it took quite a bit to renovate it and fix it up. So I renovated it, fixed it up, refinanced it, got some tenants in there. And once I got that cash flow hitting my bank account in a pretty passive sort of fashion, that was really the aha moment where it's like, okay, I need to do this like 100 times more. Now, I need to do this more and more. Like I want to basically build cash flow such that when I'm sleeping, I've still got cash coming into the account and I can start to live the life that I want to live. So at that point in time, it was really my mindset changed from an accumulation method of building towards retirement, where up until that point in time, I was socking a lot of money into the 401k to a cash flow to cover my living expenses method of building toward retirement. So if I can do this a few more times, get enough cash flow to cover my living expenses, then I can kind of go and do whatever I want. But like many people realize, I came to the realization pretty early on that, look, doing these smaller residential properties, it's not that scalable. You know, a couple hundred dollars per month of cash flow isn't anything to get too excited about. So my mindset started to shift to how can I do this on a much larger scale? How can I scale this up? Then I found the world of commercial real estate and I started diving into that. Started going to conferences, started reading books, started listening to podcasts. Eventually, I became an accredited investor, so I started investing passively as well. And I really started to like that space. It's like, you know what? Like with my institutional background in the world of finance, I think I can do this business. Like I think this is something that I could do professionally. So I started to really think about how to do that. Things were starting to get a bit more challenging. And this was actually a bit of a bit of a dark period for me, Drew. And, you know, you'll hear this and probably think, oh, that's not too bad. I'll admit, like I've lived a very blessed life and, you know, the hard things I've been through have maybe not been nearly as difficult as some other people, but here's why this was kind of a difficult time for me. This is about 2020 or so. You know, I'm the type of person, I love to be in the office, shoulder to shoulder with my team, grinding it out. And now all of a sudden I'm stuck at home every day and I'm just climbing up the walls and just don't know what to do with myself. It was really difficult for me from that perspective. Also at that point in time as well, I'd been grinding it away in my current role for about 6 years. And there was another job. I mean, I was still trying to find ways to make the best of the day job and get as much learning as I could as a great company, great people. I had this opportunity potentially for a new role at the day job. So I applied for it, went through the full interview process, lo and behold, I ended up being the runner up for that particular role. They brought somebody in external who had already done that kind of work, who was more senior, you know, reflecting on it. I don't fault the firm for it, but that for me was like the next big step in my career at that company. And I just didn't know where I was going to go after that point in time. Also, as you know, as we've kind of established now, I've viewed the world of real estate and potentially syndication as being my ticket out of the day job too. Like, look, if I can start to do bigger and bigger deals, I can leave the day job, I can have my own business, like that's going to be my pathway out. So I attempted my first syndication at this point in time as well, partnered up with some friends in Michigan. We found this commercial building down in Florida and we went to do the raise and we crashed and burned and failed horribly. We didn't come nearly as close as we needed to being able to raise the money. I thought I could raise $1 million. I ended up raising about 150,000. I went through just complete brute force. I went about 50 to 60 people deep in my Rolodex and I got 3 yeses out of that. It was completely brutal. And then the cherry on top too, that was really the most unfortunate of the whole situation, is my grandma passed away during that point in time too. And I've always been really close to my grandparents, and that's the first time I lost a close family member. So rolling all that stuff together is a really dark time for me. But there are some green shoots that started to come out of that dark period. So first of all, it really inspired me, that capital raise that went sideways, it inspired me for even more education and even more action. So I went out and I sought formalized coaching and mentoring to learn even more about the industry. And during that point in time, I joined what would have been the precursor to Raise Masters. So Hunter Thompson, who's my business partner now, it was before he started Raise Masters, he became my coach and my mentor through an earlier program. So got hooked up with Hunter, started to learn about how to raise capital. And it was really crazy too, Drew, because I've been looking for this exit escape plan for my W-2 for several years, right? Like 5 or 6 years before that. Like, how do I get out of this? Like, how can I get full-time into real estate? And it was at that point in time where I actually really needed it, right? Like, I didn't know where my W-2 job was going to go. I didn't know what the next step was. I was ready to burn the boats and really just literally ready to walk away. And that was the point in time when the opportunities started to present themselves. It was so serendipitous. So eventually what I ended up doing is I ended up joining ASIM Capital, ended up joining Hunter Thompson at ASIM Capital, left the day job. When I joined that mentorship program, I had no idea that was one of the potential outcomes. But one of the things that I think your listeners might find some inspiration, motivation from is, look, like my story is proof that you literally might be just one relationship away from making some sort of quantum leap in your business, in your personal life, whatever it is that you might be struggling with. But it's really incumbent upon you putting yourself out there. You know, go to that meetup, go to that conference that you might have to take a couple days of PTO to go to, join that mentorship group, like put yourself out there, because you literally might be one relationship away from making that next big leap. But as they say, success is when opportunity meets preparation, right? And for me, the opportunity presented itself, but I can tell you very honestly that I was prepared for it. You know, I busted my butt at the day job, building some translatable skills. I had invested passively. I had asset managed my own portfolio. Before I joined the mentorship program, I even hired an acquisitions guy who did acquisitions for a REIT for 15 years to do one-on-one training with me to teach me how to underwrite. So I'd done a lot to get ready for that situation, but that's kind of what led me from, you know, kind of this really intense corporate finance W-2 job into eventually becoming a full-time real estate investor. And, you know, to kind of fast forward the ASIM Capital story a little bit, eventually I became a partner at ASIM Capital, and Hunter has kind of made ASIM Capital my baby now too.
Yeah, that's a hell of a story, Tyler. So a lot to unpack there. But yeah, you really went for it and invested a lot in yourself. And yeah, I think you're totally right about the, you know, what luck is. Cause yeah, I'm sure if you gave like a 1 minute version of that, people would maybe say, oh, well, that's really lucky that you, met Hunter when you did and then was looking for someone to, you know, partner with or what have you. But just think how many people he had probably mentored up to that point. And then, you know, where it worked out, where you were the person who was ready to, that he saw that he could partner with, you know, what that was, you know, so that was, you know, all you're doing. So that's, yeah, it's a great story.
Right on, man.
So then how many deals had you bought on your own before let's say you started working with Hunter at ASIM then.
Yeah. So I had purchased, seven or eight smaller residential properties. So think, you know, 1 to 4 unit residential properties. And I had passively invested in a handful of just kind of a spectrum of commercial real estate deals as well, mostly multifamily. But between the stuff I had done kind of personally and then the passive investing, that's kind of about what I had done till that point in time.
Okay, nice. Yeah, and I totally get what you're saying, where yeah, those the duplex, I mean, for $75,000, like that's gonna be or the house, the first rental. I mean, like those, yeah, you'd have to have a lot of that to replace the kind of income you had. So that's I came to the a similar conclusion even when I was I started young, but even I had those properties and realized like, well, even I'll need to go get a job. It takes a lot of properties to have the cash flow add up like that.
No doubt.
Well, nice. Well, yeah, I think that's, I know you made a big move too recently. So, where you had spent your whole life in Michigan and recently moved. Let's hear about that.
Yeah. Sounds good. Happy to dive into that. And at ASIM Capital, just to give people a little bit better of a flavor, historically, ASIM Capital has been more of an equity partner sort of firm. Like really what our historical strategy used to be is we'd find best in class operators in various different niches, and we'd partner with them by raising capital for their deals and getting ourselves in the economics that way. And historically, we've done about every structure that you can imagine. We've done fund of funds, we've done co-GPs, we've been the lead sponsor. There's even a period of time too when Hunter and I were both licensed as registered representatives under a broker dealer and did equity placement that way. But as our business matured, and if you want to take it this direction, Drew, we can certainly get into more details here, but eventually we decided like, hey, you know what? We've got a lot of internal capabilities. We can raise a lot of money. Let's start, let's make a bit of a shift here and start focusing on buying our own deals in which we're the lead sponsor. So as part of that, we basically took a zero-based thinking sort of approach and really decided like if we were to start now, like where would we want to participate in the industry? So it really kicked off really thinking through, what asset class do we want to focus on? And then also what market do we want to focus on? At that point in time, by the time we made this decision, Hunter had done, he had invested passively in 50 some odd deals. I had done about a dozen or so myself. So we had this unique viewpoint on the industry where we got to work with best in class sponsors, like the best of the best. And then also, on the other end of the spectrum too, where, I've invested passively in deals, admittedly, where it's like, maybe some people should be in jail. We had seen the full spectrum of kind of, what a really good operator is. And on the other side, like what not to do. So we're able to kind of like draw from, who our favorite operators are, who best in class are, what not to do, and kind of bring this mindset forward toward kind of building this ASIM Capital 2.0. But one thing that we observed, as we kind of looked back at all of our personal investments that we had done over the years, is that multifamily just generally performed better than anything else that him and I had invested in. And then also when you look at the features of multifamily as well, Drew, I know you agree with me on this too, that it's just such a strong investment. I mean, you're investing in the lowest level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got the best debt financing possible. You don't have any sort of tenant concentration. You're going to have, several doors in one building. You don't have to worry about one single tenant. There was a lot that we liked about the multifamily space. So it's like, okay, we are going to go multifamily. And then it kind of came to the discussion around like, what markets do we focus on? And if you look across the landscape of the US, like where you can invest in multifamily, from our perspective, we generally like the locales that are landlord friendly and business friendly, job growth, population growth, wage growth, really all the things that you hear bandied about quite a bit when it comes to the multifamily space. Like this isn't secret sauce necessarily. And you might say to yourself like, okay, Tyler, you guys are focusing on Phoenix, but in terms of those characteristics you just mentioned, well, hey, Dallas has the same thing. Tampa has the same thing. Nashville does. The Carolinas do. Like, why Phoenix? There are a lot of different markets that have those particular characteristics. As we started to dig a little bit deeper on Phoenix, there are a few different things that really stuck out to us that we think are really, really important. So one additional thing that I'd mention that makes Phoenix somewhat unique relative to those other strong markets that I mentioned, first of all, you've got a lot higher predictability of your non-controllable expenses in Phoenix. And what do I mean by that? First of all, from a property tax perspective, your property taxes are capped out at a 5% increase every year. And we see in other markets, like you look at Texas in particular right now, which I'm not dogging on Texas. I love Texas. I'm invested passively in Texas. Like, go invest in Texas. Like, I love Texas, but it's really been nailed by property tax increases, right? It's difficult with property taxes in Texas. I mean, a lot of people are hiring attorneys to kind of go and argue their property tax bills for them every single year because it's just, it's kind of insane how much property taxes have went up there. But then also from an insurance cost perspective as well, one of the things that Phoenix has going for it is it has a lack of natural disasters. You know, you don't have hurricanes, you don't have tornadoes, you don't have floods and earthquakes. It's much more insulated from that perspective. And because of that, the insurance costs in Phoenix are much lower and they tend to be a bit less volatile too. It's not been completely immune to insurance cost increases. Insurance costs have definitely gone up for sure, but not as severely as Florida, Texas, some of these other states that have a bit more issues with natural disasters. Another thing to think about here too, Drew, from an insurance cost perspective, is that in the Phoenix market, you might be underwriting to something like $400 per unit from an insurance cost perspective, give or take, depending on property, vintage, neighborhood, so on and so forth. So if your property taxes increase 30%, it's increasing 30% on a $400 base, that's going to hurt a lot less than if you're in a market where you're underwriting to $1,200 per unit property taxes, and then your insurance goes up 30%. You see what I mean? So that was something that was really important to us. Then the last thing that I'd mention too is that any market that you're going to focus on, you're going to spend a lot of time there. So for me personally, when we made this change, I knew before I even told Hunter, and before I even told my spouse, by the way, which I don't recommend doing that. Always tell your spouse first. But I knew in my mind that, look, if we make this change and focus on this market, we're going to relocate down there and actually be in that market, which that kind of led off the conversation here, right, Drew, is like, I moved from Michigan. I live in Scottsdale area now. It's amazing. We're loving it here. But I'd also say that whatever market that you choose to focus on, make sure it's a market that you like to be in, because you're going to need to spend a lot of time there, especially if you're like me and you're the boots on the ground guy who's looking at deals and building the broker relationships and doing that kind of stuff. Make sure it's somewhere you like to spend time in. And for me and my wife, we had vacationed down in Arizona plenty of times before, and we knew we loved it down there anyway. So that was kind of the last factor, I'd say, that when you think about, okay, why Phoenix? Like, why am I down here now? Like, those are kind of the main factors for it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's, I don't even know where to start. You covered a lot there. But yeah, that's, we've saw the same. You know, we've bought 5 deals in Phoenix, as you know, and they, you know, we were drawn to the same things where we saw, you know, the rent growth, we saw how those operating expenses were moving. You know, and yeah, there wasn't anywhere where it had such high, you know, top line, you know, revenue growth with such small expense growth. And I've literally said to people the same thing about growing a smaller number, you know, too, like the taxes are low there. I mean, we have a $25 million deal and our taxes are like 40 grand a year on it. That's in Phoenix. And then we have a $33 million deal in Chicago and our taxes are $550,000. So It's like, if one goes up 3% in a given year, like there's a bigger change on one of them.
Interesting about that too, Drew, that I'll just kind of add and interject here is that, of course, for some of these other markets that do have higher property taxes, sponsors are going to price that in, right? They're going to price that into their underwriting. So it's not necessarily because in Phoenix, we've got such low property taxes. It's like, it's this complete windfall. In these other markets, they are pricing it in. But for us, like the appeal to it was really the predictability of outcome, where it's like, you're not worried and on bated breath about what taxes and insurance are going to do. It's just more predictable. So you've just got, it makes it a little bit easier to perform to plan. You know what I mean? At least when it comes to those non-controllable expenses.
Yeah, I totally know what you're saying, because I've explained the same thing like 100 times, because you're, you know, these places where you don't know how it's going to work necessarily, and you're just hoping it's going to be like what, you know, your tax attorney told you or whatever. Like that's, you know, that could ruin your whole business plan if that things move more than you thought. So, and that's, yeah, that's, yeah, I've noticed all the same. I think, have you, what sort of steps then did you take? How did you break into the market then? Cause if I'm following the timeline right, you were in Michigan, you didn't probably know people doing real estate in Phoenix. And then, you know, these brokers, you know, they're used to selling to, you know, people already that they have done business with. Like, how are you guys breaking into the Phoenix market?
Yeah, it's a really good question, man. It's a really good question. And one thing I will add too is that while we did take kind of a zero-based thinking sort of approach to Phoenix, we did at least have some familiarity with it as well before we went all in, because we did some capital raising and some equity placement in Phoenix too. So we did kind of have, we had very minimal relationships. We did have some relationships, because when you're placing equity, you're really kind of partnering with the sponsor. So it's really more the sponsor that has those kind of boots on the ground relationships. So yeah, happy to kind of riff a bit here on some of the things that we've thought about in terms of just kind of breaking into the market, building those relationships, so on and so forth. And the first one is going to be kind of, it's going to be kind of obvious, but it's one of those things that it needs to be stated because most people aren't going to do it anyway, right? So commercial real estate, it's a simple business, but it's a hard business because most people don't do the things that you need to do to actually have success in it. But the first thing you want to do when you kind of break into a new market, like for us, when we were kind of breaking into Phoenix, yeah, first of all, it's identifying who the brokers are that you need to get connected with. And for us, we did have some connections in the market already. So it was kind of some sponsors that we knew were willing to give us some warm kind of connections to brokers of like, hey, look, go talk to these 10 guys, which for us was helpful. But if you're a listener out there and you don't have that connection yet and you want to start building some of those broker relationships, look, you can look on LoopNet, you can look on Crexy. These are basically like the free Zillows for commercial real estate. And if you want to focus on 20 to 50 unit properties in Chicago, go on those sites and find out who the brokers are that are listing those types of properties. And as we talk, and as many people have probably talked about on the show before, you know, LoopNet and Crexy, I mean, these are kind of the places where, you know, kind of deals go to die, as people sometimes joke, like you might not find the best deals there, but really it's about finding who those brokers are and reaching out and making connections with those brokers. And the way that I think about this too is that when I build relationships with brokers, I genuinely go into this from the perspective of I want to make a friend. You know, like I want this to be somebody that I enjoy golfing with, like we can go out and have dinner or drinks. You know, maybe we pack up after NMHC and head up to Vegas for a night or two. Like the people that I know who are crushing it in the acquisitions game, they've got that type of cozy relationship with brokers. So you really want to go into it with the perspective of really wanting to make friends with these people. And for me, one of the things that's been a huge benefit is we burned the boats and moved from Michigan down to Arizona. Like I don't know anybody down here. So I genuinely do want to make friends. And it just so happens a lot of brokers down here are really cool. So that's what I'd say is like, focus on making a friend, get to know them as individuals. Don't be too robotic. Don't be too transactional. Like try to make a friend, get to know who they are as people, you know, get to know what their interests are. And, you know, who knows, like maybe once you start building that relationship, maybe there are some common interests. For me, I like to golf. A lot of brokers like to golf. So sometimes we'll hang out and golf, you know, like try to figure out what those common common interests are. And I'd say, you know, build up to that relationship too. It's like when you're in junior high school and you're dating the girl, like you want to hold her hand before you go in for the kiss, right? Like you don't want to invite a broker to a weekend ski trip to Aspen when it's the second time you've talked to them, right? Like kind of warm up to that relationship, but really truly try to make it a friendship. And if I can give you just like a quick case study of something that I experienced recently. So we moved here about 7 or 8 months ago. And when we moved here, you know, I connected with a lot of the brokers who are here in town, and I had known and connected with them previously already as well. But when I moved here, I gave them a heads up like, hey, look, moving into town, really excited about it, you know, texting back and forth, emailing back and forth, just like letting them know what's going on in my life and that we're going to be making this big move. And then this one broker in particular, when I got into town, like, hey, why don't we meet up and grab coffee? We met up, we grabbed coffee. And for his most recent deal that he had. We wrote an offer on it. We didn't get the deal, but I followed up with him, reached back out, got detailed feedback on how far we were off, like what we need to do to be more competitive in this market, you know, kept the dialogue going. I didn't write an offer, but I underwrote another one of his deals recently, called him up, gave him some detailed feedback. We held a golf outing before Rays Fest a few weeks ago. I invited him to the golf outing. He wasn't able to make it, but he felt good to have been invited. And that just initiated some friendly dialogue and conversations. And the last time I talked to him about a week or so ago, he's like, "Hey, look, man, we don't have anything right now, but we've got some properties coming that are in this range. I want to get something on the scoreboard with you guys this year. So like, let's make it happen. Just be patient. Like, it's going to happen for you guys pretty soon here." It's like, awesome. Like, that was an amazing conversation, but that doesn't happen overnight. It's because I've kind of built and nurtured those relationships. So yeah, finding the brokers, building those relationships, that's really important. When you do start building those broker relationships, pretty much if you're breaking into a new market, they're going to send you whatever they have. Basically, they're going to send you whatever junk it is that's kind of sitting there gathering dust that's just not moving. But you've got to be ready to rip through those deals and evaluate them. Because if they send you some deal and it's just crickets, they're probably not going to send you more deals. So you're breaking into a new market and connecting with these brokers, make sure you've got the bandwidth to get through those deals. You know, when we were first really making our big push into Phoenix, me and our analyst Bobby were incredibly busy underwriting a bunch of deals because when we first come in, everybody starts blasting you with all their junk that's still sitting there gathering dust, right? So you've got to underwrite those deals. You got to give them feedback. So that's really important as well. And I would say probably the most important bit of advice that I can give people though, for who are breaking into a new market, and people always talk about broker relationships. People don't talk about this enough though. Know the other owners and principals who are in your market. Mm-hmm. Drew, you'll probably recall, like when we were first breaking into Phoenix, like you and I had some dialogue, right? It's like, "Hey man, next time you're in Phoenix, let's hang out. Let's grab lunch. Let's grab a beer." You know, like get to know the other owners in your market, because when you're writing offers on deals, of course the broker is going to facilitate the transaction. But at the end of the day, if you golfed with that seller a week or two ago and you guys are friends and they see your name on that deal sheet, that's going to pay dividends for you. That's going to pay dividends for you. And another example I saw of this very recently, of this paying dividends for us, it didn't quite work out, but we wrote an offer a couple weeks ago on a deal that we really like. Really, we're excited about this deal. It's like, okay, like this is the one, let's go get it. Unfortunately, we didn't get chosen, but we did know a group that was in best and final. And because we had a really strong relationship with them, they came to us and they're like, "Hey, look, we're best and final for this particular deal." I'm like, "Oh yeah, like I know that deal." And they're like, "If we get this deal, like we're probably going to want a co-GP on this particular deal. Would you guys be interested in partnering on this deal with us and taking it down?" So of any advice that I can give you in terms of working a market, that would probably be my best advice, is really getting to know the other owners in the market.
Yeah, that's great. And it's interesting too. It's the other owners are surprisingly friendly. And this, you know, this even held true in Chicago, where, recently I was bidding against somebody on a deal and he had called me to ask about the other properties I own in that neighborhood. And actually the deal he was bidding on, I was not looking at the time. But then the broker called and said it was going to go for $5 million less than the ask price. So then I got interested. But then I called that owner back and said, "Okay, now I'm going to start looking, because now I heard about the new price." But we're very, it's surprising how friendly people are, where it's still competitive, you know, so it's not like I was going to just yield, like say like, "Hey, he's already looking at it, so I won't." But, I gave him the answers. You know, half the stuff was things he could have just found on Zillow anyways. And then, you know, so yeah, that will surprise you, or even, cause you think maybe, I don't know what Chicago's reputation is compared to Phoenix, but I was just saying that cause it would seem like it's, you know, it's a lot of tough people there, right? But it's just like anywhere else, where even they're very friendly. And yeah, I did the same playbook Tyler's talking about when I moved to Chicago a long time ago. And then when we got going in Phoenix, we're doing the same stuff, except we also had, you know, done deals with most of these brokers that, too, if you don't go on Crexie or LoopNet, like it's just the national brokerage firms. you know, JLL, CBRE, Marcus & Millichap. So you can look up just on their website who the brokers are. And then you just, you call them, you email them, and then they'll point you to the right direction. Where if you email the managing director who just sells the $100 million deals and you're looking for $5 million ones, he'll still respond. He'll just say it's, you know, it's this other guy, and then add them to the email. So we've done the same thing. And then once you're in one market, then you try to get a referral from the people you've already worked with in that market within the same company where, you know, like, and it's just all those same national firms. So that's how we did, where if we were getting in best and final, then I'd say, you should really talk to the guy in Chicago at, you know, Colliers or Marcus & Millichap or wherever, and just, you know, see how real we are. And then that would always help too. So
definitely.
Well, nice. Well, yeah, Tyler, what kind of deals are working today? So maybe what was the profile of that one that you really liked? Like, what is hitting like the return metrics that you guys want, and also that would generate enough investor interest from like the passive investors, the passive investors or limited partners? Like, what are you seeing today?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will say too that in Phoenix right now, it's a pretty, there's not a whole lot trading right now. It's pretty slow still. And we can elaborate on that further if you'd like to later in the conversation here, but it's pretty slow. I mean, pretty much everything that we're underwriting, we're a good solid 15% below guidance. So it's there's still a pretty big bid ask gap. There's still not a whole lot trading. But the last couple of deals that we did, the profile was they were lighter value add properties. So they had received quite a bit of CapEx already. And they had a pretty good going in cap rate as well, right? Like a pretty good cash yield. And but still had some value add opportunities, like in good shape, generating good cash flow, so on and so forth. But still had some good
Going in. Would that be like, what's a good cap rate in Phoenix going in, would you say?
Yeah, I would say kind of for your kind of bread and butter value add, like in the high fives is kind of, you know, if you can kind of end up somewhere somewhere in that space, you're probably going to be in a pretty good spot. So that's kind of that's been kind of the profile of the last few that we've done, but still like some meat of the bone, right? Like still opportunities, like, okay, opportunities to roll out other income programs and to optimize the other income a little bit better. Opportunities to maybe still renovate some classic units or maybe take some upgraded units to platinum level. Some operational opportunities as well, maybe to manage expenses a little bit better. And also in terms of leverage, I would say, at least with our investor base, so anything that's got like massive negative leverage right now is a really hard sell. It's a really hard sell. The last couple of deals that we've done, they're pretty much like right around neutral leverage, slightly positive, with a really strong pathway to very strong positive leverage in year one. Strong debt service coverage ratio, you know, like 1.4x or so right out of the gate, maybe better. That's kind of what we're seeing. And right now, older vintage is a little bit more difficult. You know, if you're kind of like 80s, 90s or newer, that's still pretty good. But if you start getting into 70s and olders, that can be a little bit more difficult. Although I will say, if you get into older vintage, if it's got other redeeming qualities and characteristics that make it interesting, it can still be a deal that's going to attract investor interest. Like if you got an older property, but it's a stone's throw away from Old Town Scottsdale or something like that, like that's going to generate some investor interest. If you have an older property that's already received a lot of CapEx and the boilers and chillers have already been taken out, it's got individual HVAC units, you can have some mitigating factors in place that make an older property more marketable to investors. But yeah, I would say right now, older properties with a lot of negative leverage, like that's a bit of a tougher sell for investors right now.
Yeah, so then a lot of focus on cash flow and positive leverage basically is what we're hearing from investors.
Definitely.
Yeah, that and so then what on those kind of deals you're talking, or maybe it's value add, like a light value add starts out at a mid five cap. What kind of cap rate do you see those deals stabilizing at? Or at least where you're underwriting to, I guess.
Yeah, so we're if we can get kind of a yield on cost north of 7 or so, like that's usually going to kind of back into the type of IRR that we need to offer to investors. So it's like it's a lighter value add, but you know, we still need meat on the bone. Like there still has to be an opportunity to create value at the property level. Because the thing is that a lot of properties that we're seeing right now as well, there are properties that have been traded and touched a lot the last 5 to 7 years. So if you're looking at a property, it's like, holy cow, they already have a bunch of other income programs and the residents are being feed to death, you know, by fees. Yeah. And if there just isn't a whole lot of room to push rents from a renovation perspective, because a lot of the units have been renovated already, well, holy cow, they're putting some of the repairs and maintenance expenses below the line as well. Like the NOI for this property is already priced to perfection. If you have those situations like that, where you there's not tangible value that you know you can create yourself, well, then where does the return come from to be able to get an IRR that's going to be palatable to investors? Then you start to, then you're in a situation where it's like, well, I need to buy it like a super high cash yield.
I mean, in a normal market where they're not attracting investors. They're just investing their own money. Where, you know, guys like me and you, we need to do something extra to the property to generate high enough returns, you know, for our investors. Where if it's your own money and you're already kind of just building this big snowball, a lot of those folks, they look at it too and they're like, oh, that'll be a lot of work to buy that property from the 90s and then do all this stuff to it. Yeah, I'd make a little bit more money, but I could just like buy another deal with my other money. You know, like that's their thought process. Yeah. Like I know some of those people and, you know, it's a good position to be in where me and you, we see that and go like, there's not enough like juice to squeeze out of this thing. We got to let it go.
So. Exactly. Another thing that I'd add too, in terms of deal profile, Drew, and this is, I think is really good, just kind of given we're in the market cycle right now, but these deals as well, they're low to mid 60s leverage point, long-term agency financing. So if you think about the risks of the type of deals that we're doing now and contrast that to the type of deals that are being done in, you know, late 2020, 2021, early 2022, the risk profile is so much different, right? It's like we're pricing in much lower rent growth. We're pricing in a much higher exit cap rate. And then you've got fixed long-term agency financing on top of it at a very low and manageable leverage point. That's, I think the debt piece is another thing that's really important in this conversation as well, because it just completely transforms, in my humble opinion, the risk profile of the deal.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, where there's so much, you know, everything was underwritten, you know, 2-3 years ago, where it was basically in retrospect, like planning on everything going perfectly and people taking variable rate interest loans and, you know, everything moved to, you know, against them, unfortunately. But now you're moving, now you're buying at, you know, today's levels where interest rates are already relatively high compared to the last, you know, few years. And then rental rates are down, like where it's, you know, pricing is down as well. So like you're buying at a much totally different point where a lot of the risk that was sort of in the market, like that happened, like it moved against those people. Now you're buying at a new, you know, totally different price and structure, as you're saying, where now you're putting down more money, getting fixed rate debt. Yeah, so that makes sense. Like the risk, you know, I saw somebody, they were joking, but it was honestly not really wrong, where they were kidding about something. They're like, the risk is to the upside. And it was, if you looked at what how the deal had got set up, it was like this, you know, it's kind of just kidding, but it was like, where do you think this will like deviate from the underwriting? They were joking, like it's where we'll beat it. That's where it'll deviate. Like interest rates aren't gonna, you know, we're not, when we refi in 5 years, I doubt like our rents will be down and the rate will be higher. He was just kidding, but it was, you know, wasn't actually probably wrong. So
right.
Well, nice. Well, yeah. When do you think we're gonna see any of this distress? Like kind of your you know, because I know what you're, I mean, just roughly speaking, a lot of these people, you know, in 2021 were buying deals thinking they'd stabilize them where, you know, they'd make a 5% return if there was no debt on it. So stabilize them in like a 5 cap. And now interest rates on their loans went to 8 or 9%. The fixed rate money is still, you know, over 5%. So then it's negative leverage even then. And like you were saying, a lot of those deals were set up high leverage. And I mean, and we weren't immune to this. We did one this way too. So we have a deal we need to, you know, be careful with how we refi and how we proceed with it. But we, you know, there's so many deals like this one we have where there's been hundreds of them sold like that in Phoenix and then thousands in probably thousands in Phoenix too, but just all over the place. So yeah, when do you think we're going to start seeing those kind of deals shaken loose?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm of the mindset too, that even in the highly transacted growth markets where people got really aggressive, I don't know that we're necessarily going to see some sort of massive distress. Like, I don't think we're going to get to that point. I think we'll see some very targeted instances of distress, but, you know, kind of what we're seeing and what we're hearing is, for a lot of these deals that are a bit more troubled, the lenders have some level of willingness. Oftentimes, if the operator's not a slouch, to try to work with people, to try to kick the can down the road. If it's like a 3+1+1 sort of debt structure, hey, look, I know you're not hitting the debt yield covenants to be able to extend, but you know what? We're gonna give you a little more time here. We're gonna work with you. We don't want to start taking a bunch of these properties back. You know, maybe the operator needs to come to the table with some sort of, you know, cash infusion to get to buy themselves a bit more time. So I think we're going to see lenders and operators work together a lot to try to get past some of these issues. But of course, there are going to be some instances where it's too far gone and there's nothing that could be done. So from a timing perspective, I think that, you know, second half of 2024, some of that stuff is probably going to start to pick up a little bit because, you know, a lot of those deals were three-year terms. And a lot of that stuff did get bought, you know, in 2021, early 2022. So some of that stuff is kind of starting to come home to roost. There are a few different deals that we've been monitoring closely where it is kind of a tough situation like that, you know, and we're kind of seeing the guidance price just kind of gradually start to work its way down. And, you know, there are deals that we've underwritten 5-6 times the last year that we're just kind of monitoring and keeping an eye on. It's like, hey, look, we're still a couple million dollars off or 10% off or whatever it is. But, you know, when the seller does kind of get to a situation where they're ready to transact and move on and kind of live to fight another day, like here's kind of where we're at. So we're kind of monitoring a lot of those deals right now, but there hasn't been enough pain quite yet for some of these to really shake loose. But from a timing perspective, when some of that stuff does start to move, I would venture to guess probably second half of this year, we're going to start to see a bit more of that stuff.
And then how are you guys going about sourcing them? What's your plan with that?
Yeah. So a lot of this stuff we've really focused on the broker relationship. So, you know, we're not trying to go out and do off market stuff necessarily. You know, if you're focusing on deals that are, you know, call them $20 million deals, roughly give or take, It's a bit more difficult to find just these mom and pop off market sort of opportunities. So we're staying tight with the brokers. Some of these deals that I alluded to, it's kind of, you see them kind of float from one brokerage to another, everybody trying to like give it a try to kind of float it out there and see what they can get. So, you know, we're close enough with the brokers that we know what these deals are and we're monitoring them and kind of just waiting for that time to come around. You know, they kind of know that we're ready to rock and roll when that opportunity comes. They kind of know roughly where we stand on these deals and what our number is. So we're kind of just patiently waiting, keeping our underwriting updated, you know, making sure we've got updated rent rolls, P&Ls, we're monitoring the performance of some of these properties. And yeah, hopefully when the time comes, when the seller is in that position where they are ready to move on, we're hopeful that our phone number will get called.
Love it. All right, let's leave it there, Tyler. Appreciate it. So how can people get in touch with you then?
Yeah, a couple different ways you can get in touch with me. The best way would be to just reach out to me on LinkedIn. You can find me, it's just Tyler Lyons on LinkedIn. It's Tyler Lyons, I think it's hyphen real estate. And I'm pretty active on there, so you should find me pretty easily. And I do have a free gift. Drew, maybe I can come back on the show some other time and we can talk about fund to funds a little bit. But I do have a free gift for your listeners as well if they'd like to take a look at it. It's a program that my business partner and I developed. It's called Fund to Funds Mastery. If you are a person who wants to focus more on raising capital and not be as involved in the operations, you can check out, just Google search Fund to Funds Mastery, and you get an amazing free course on how to use the Fund to Funds model to participate in the world of commercial real estate.
Love it. Yeah, we'll put links in the description for all that because it's a lot to write down if you're hearing it. So love it, Tyler. Yeah, thanks for being on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Drew. Really appreciate it, man.
If you learned something from today's show, leave a review and hit that subscribe button wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Dive deeper into real estate investing on Brenneman Capital's website, Brenneman.com, where we have numerous free resources and information that can help both active and passive real estate investors. Accredited investors can get started today as a passive investor in our multifamily investment opportunities by hitting the Invest Now button on our website.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of Drew Brenneman and guests as of the date of recording and do not purport to reflect the views or opinions of Brenneman Capital LLC and its subsidiaries. Views and opinions are provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon or deemed as investment or tax advice or an offer to buy or sell securities. The speaker cannot be held responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of